Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 4th, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A truly lovely and beautiful afternoon. I hope you have a chance to look out the window or be outside as you listen to the show today, if you're listening to it live. If you're podcasting it, well, you're missing or you've experienced a tremendous Sunday afternoon this June in Central Illinois. Today we have a wonderful show for you, a guest we've had on in the past, one of the leading radio personalities of liberal or progressive media in the United States today. Laura Flanders from Radio Nation and Air America will be joining us for the hour, so please stay tuned for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The issue of network neutrality is now the number one telecommunications issue facing the U.S. Congress. As a result, lawmakers are looking to associate their names with internet freedom, and this has led to an explosion of competing bills pending in the House and Senate. There are six pieces of legislation in all. The two front runners are the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act in the House and the Communications Consumers Choice and Broadband Deployment Act in the Senate. Both of these bills deal with a wide range of telecom issues and thus are likely to be the legislative vehicles that will ultimately come up for votes. And although they have nice names, the bad news is neither of the bills contain any meaningful provisions when it comes to protecting internet freedom. The COPE Act allows the FCC to investigate cases of data discrimination, but it's prohibited from actually making rules on the subject, while the Senate omnibus bill simply asks the FCC to study net neutrality and report back to Congress. That's why four other bills have been introduced explicitly dealing with the issue. In the House, the frontrunner is the Internet Freedom and Non-Discrimination Act, which has bipartisan sponsorship and treats net neutrality as an antitrust issue. This bill cleared the House Judiciary Committee late last month, although Republican House leadership may conspire to keep the bill from coming up to the floor for a full vote. The other House bill, the Network Neutrality Act of 2006, currently languishes in the House's Commerce Committee. On the Senate side, two similar bills await review by the Senate Commerce Committee, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and Internet Non-Discrimination Act, both of which would essentially prohibit phone and cable companies from extorting cash from online content providers in exchange for smooth service. The Internet Freedom Preservation Act also has bipartisan sponsorship. At a recent Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality, Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott put the political momentum for preserving an open internet into some impressive perspective.
Together, the audience of the net neutrality bloggers exceeds the readership of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post combined. This is the online democratic public sphere in potent action.
And in an exchange with Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota and one of the co-sponsors of the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, Scott warned the Congress that those who oppose network neutrality do so at their own peril.
And what are the consequences if the Congress says, you know what, let's do nothing and whatever happens, happens out there?
I think that the hundreds of thousands of people that are currently engaged will become tens of millions, and we'll suddenly see a revolt on the internet, the likes of which has never occurred before.
The weakest of the Senate bills is expected to come up for a vote before the Commerce Committee in a couple of weeks, while a full House vote on the COPE Act is expected any day now. Meanwhile, phone and cable companies continue to shovel money into fake coalitions and an avalanche of advertising that tries to portray internet freedom as some sort of quasi-socialist concept. They're still spending at least $1 million a week on this campaign. The Save the Internet Coalition has spent less than 1% of that in total and has managed to unite groups ranging from the Christian Coalition to the Feminist Majority with more than 5,000 blogs, nearly 10,000 MySpace friends, and more than 750,000 signatories to a petition to Congress asking it to protect free speech online.
At first glance, Bowling Green, Ohio might not seem like a mecca for independent media making, but for one weekend in June, it becomes one when the Allied Media Conference comes to town.
This is our eighth year, And we're really building a community of people that are trying to radically transform the way we see media, the way we use media to change the world.
That's Josh Breitbart, one of the conference organizers. Several hundred media activists of all stripes will converge on the campus of Bowling Green State University from June 23rd to the 25th for this year's AMC, whose theme is From Truth to Power, Because Being Right is Not Enough, designed to challenge independent media makers on what their ultimate aims should be.
Because of the tendency that we've seen for independent media to report information and then stop and feel like that that's enough. And yet, historical circumstances seem to have shown us that that's not enough.
The AMC weekend features a plethora of workshops and panels covering a wide range of issues, from the basics of organizing around media to how to make media policy more understandable and actionable. A film festival is also part of the weekend. Visit alliedmediaconference.org for the full rundown.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL, AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a lovely June 4th, 2006, Sunday afternoon. We have a wonderful guest for you today, coming to us live from New York City, Laura Flanders, host of Radio Nation with Laura Flanders, heard all the time on the Air America radio station, not carried, unfortunately, in the local Urbana-Champaign area, but you can get it online at www.airamericaradio.com. Laura Flanders is no stranger to our listeners, having been a guest in our program several times before, author of many outstanding books on media and politics, and it is a pleasure to welcome her today. Laura, welcome.
Hey, glad to be back, Bob.
Well, it's really a privilege to have you here, and I know that this is not a day off for you or a day of lounging, but you're going on the air later today, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not on all the time. I'm on Saturday and Sunday, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
And you're based out of New York City, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Down there in Greenwich Village, isn't it, or nearby?
Nearby. The new Air America radio stations are in Chelsea.
In Chelsea. Okay, great. Who do you have on your show today?
Well, today we're going to have Marcy Winograd, who is the Progressive Democrats of America candidate from Los Angeles, running a really upstart primary challenge to Congresswoman Jane Harman, mostly on the war. So that'll be pretty interesting. And then every Sunday we do a media roundtable where we bring in journalists from different sorts of media outlets to talk about the job their profession did every week. And we've got Sean Gonzalez, who's a writer with the Cape Cod Times, interesting guy, gets syndicated all over.
Yeah, I see his stuff everywhere.
And Laura Rosen from the American Prospect, who knew the CBS journalist Kimberly Dozier, who was critically injured this week. So it should be an interesting conversation. We'll talk about the coverage of Iran and Iraq, and I think also the coverage of Hillary Clinton as a candidate in 08.
Those are subjects I want to talk about today on Media Matters as well. Now, I understand you're writing a new book or working on a new book in all your free time.
I am. I still am. It should be done sometime this September, and it's going to be out next year. At the moment, it's called Blue Grit. What do you think? It's about progressive victories in these times and what the Democratic Party leadership could learn from those victories if they felt like it.
Hopefully it's a long book and not a short book.
I will take the fifth on that.
Okay, very good. Laura Flanders, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. All topics are open when you have Laura Flanders on the air, so feel free to call in with any questions or comments. The number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Laura Flanders was the founding director of the Women's Desk at the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And for more than 10 years, she produced and co-hosted Counterspin, Fair's nationally syndicated radio program. We've had Janine Jackson and Peter Hart and Steve Rendell all as our guests on the show numerous times. And it's sort of like Fair's outpost here in the Midwest. Laura, you're an alumni.
Thanks.
There's a few big stories in the news I know you've been following, and I'd really be interested to get your take on them before we get much further. The Murtha revelations are sort of comments on the Haditha massacre, and now an increased amount of attention to the war crimes that have been taking place at the hands of U.S. troops in Iraq. What's your take on this?
Well, it's very interesting because mine is a weekend show, we get to cover things that other people typically don't and catch all those stories that break late on a Friday evening. And that exactly was the case on this Haditha story. Now, we all know we're talking about an event that happened last November, but the most recent revelations are prompted by Jack Murther of Pennsylvania going public with this on Memorial Day weekend. We had very interesting conversations with our audience Saturday and Sunday because, you know, it's a tough conversation to have on Memorial Day, but Murther did it very, very well and really demanded a response. He's been gradually getting it. But what's disturbing to me, or what I think is important for us to acknowledge, is you've got a media now who used the term this week, pylon, that reporters were piling on as they covered different incidents of civilian killings by Americans. Now, this is not a pylon. These are very much, as I understand it, the tip of the iceberg, and Darja Mail made that point in an Iraqi reporter who's covered Iraq a lot, made that point in a piece he had syndicated this week. While we're talking civilian killings, we have yet to talk about the civilian death count in Iraq overall since the invasion. We know that as of, you know, a year and a half ago, it was 100,000 as measured by the Lancet. And what about Fallujah? If you want to talk war crimes, we have to talk about our far bigger than My Lai, if you ask me, destruction of that city, our Jenin. And that is yet to percolate up. So two things, interesting timing on the release, interesting revelation in the press on Friday, the New York Times, that the president learned about this whole incident, this military investigation, from the Time magazine article. And thirdly, that now, after just a very limited number of days talking about it, there's a tendency in the press for people to be saying, enough already, we've heard too much.
You know, what was your response when you first heard Murtha with his comments and heard about Haditha? I mean, what did you think, oh, this is just like a fluke? Or, I mean, how do you contextualize Haditha?
Well, I think Murtha is a man who does not speak up until he feels he absolutely has to. And we know that he said as much about his statements last fall calling for a deadline on troop redeployment. Not pull out, but redeployment in the region. Not the most radical position in the world, but a clear one. And he clearly came to that conclusion after his contacts in the military had just come to him one too many times with their frustration and despair about the situation that they're in. So too, I think, with Haditha, this story was going to come out. Time magazine was investigating. The military was investigating. And Murtha heard, as people always hear during wartime, from those members of the military who are concerned that if a cover-up continues, the entire military gets tarred with the brush of war criminals when there, you know, needs to be an investigation of a specific line of command. Now, in this case, you know, my initial response was, oh, here we go again, Abu Ghraib. We're going to have two bottom-level foot soldiers take the rap for incompetence at the highest level. And I actually had the chance to go on Lou Dobbs' show last week, and sure enough, their question was, should some generals be fired? And I said, it's not the generals that should be fired. It's Donald Rumsfeld who should be fired. And then, you know, stepping back from the specifics, whether you're talking Haditha or Fallujah or the other incidents we've heard of since, this is reality of war. And we're kidding ourselves if we think you can have a war without civilian casualties. Far from it. 90% of the casualties in a war are civilians. And that's not to excuse war crimes, but simply to say this is why we were against the war. This is why war should be the last resort, not ever an action of choice. So those were sort of the array of reactions that I had, and mostly I just felt, you know, misery for the Iraqi families who were barely even, I mean, if you talk to Iraqi reporters, as we did last weekend about this story, they said it wasn't even a big story there. Why? Because it happens all the time.
You know, looking at what's been happening in Iraq, prior to the Iraq invasion and occupation, probably in my lifetime, and certainly in the second half of the 20th century, the Vietnam War was sort of the signature failure war of the United States, and it produced a number of war crimes, My Lai, the most famous, but I think widely understood that that was not uncommon activities that went on in Vietnam. How do you think historically the Iraq War is going to measure up compared to the Vietnam War in the United States history?
Well, from the positive, can we say we have more of a peace movement sooner than we did last time? From the negative, you know, the biggest indictment of it all is that we're in a Vietnam-like situation when we should have learned the lessons of Vietnam. I don't know how else to put it, but I think that, you know, it was actually well put, I think, by Maureen Dowd yesterday, where she said, you know, with respect to Iraq, this was a war that was supposed to, illustrate that we had, you know, banished post-Vietnam syndrome, so-called. Instead, we've revived it. This was a war that was supposed to make America more feared and beloved. It's made us more hated. Was supposed to help terrorism, help stop terrorism, actually helped terrorism increase. I don't know. I just, over the last few months, reread David Halberstam's Best and the Brightest, mm-hmm. which is, I think, probably one of the definitive accounts of the Vietnam War and how the U.S. got into it under the Kennedy administrations. And it's just horrifying how many similarities there are, from the denial of intelligence to the ignoring of warnings from the left and from inside an administration, to the arrogance of leadership that think that the reality on the ground is a detail and you don't need to understand the culture into which you're plummeting. I don't know. I'd love to hear your take on that. I don't think we're anywhere near the end of this Iraq story, so it's hard to compare.
Well, I agree. It's premature to probably draw the any sort of serious analysis or comparisons since we're in the midst. Who knows where we are in Iraq, actually. But we're certainly not done with it. It's not in anyone's rearview mirror. But, you know, as you look at Iraq, one thing that does seem striking to me is that I had family members who fought in Vietnam. And, you know, they told me that when they got over there, it was pretty clear to them that, you know, it was Americans fighting Vietnamese. It wasn't like there were two Vietnamese armies fighting each other and they were sort of helping out in the back with the one side help fighting the other. But in fact, it was American soldiers fighting Vietnamese people and soldiers, in effect. But there, you know, those were the two sides. And in that context, it made sense that all Vietnamese people were suspicious to an American soldier and a threat to them. And it seems like you have a similar scenario in Iraq. It's the scenario that all occupying forces face when they enter other countries.
I think you're right, and one of the big differences, I think, is that when it comes to the media coverage and to how much the public here are aware of what's happening, the differences between the Vietnam years and these Iraq years couldn't be more stark. I was very taken this week by the media response, particularly the broadcast media response to the blast that killed two CBS crew members and seriously injured a third. A lot of the discussion in TV was about, this just shows how difficult it is to report from Iraq, and we need to bring out our people, and, that's why you can't get good reporting. And my initial reaction was, well, that's baloney. Look at Time Magazine. We don't, you know, networks shouldn't get, don't have any excuse not to cover the reality of what's happening. And then I was taken to see a piece in the LA Times published yesterday where TV reporters responded to the CBS deaths and said, you know, we're not frustrated that we're working in a dangerous situation. We're frustrated that our editors are not putting our news, our reports on the news. That the demand for storytelling from Iraq is shrinking, not growing, and that even as the risks we take escalate, the interest in what we're doing seems to shrink. So I thought that was a fascinating media insight, that these reporters are saying there's a drop in coverage, not because it's too dangerous, which is the easy conclusion people jump to after this bomb blast, but because the American public are perceived not to care, which is to say the networks don't want to put it on the air.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the host of Radio Nation with Laura Flanders, heard every Saturday and Sunday on the Air America Radio Network. And you can always go find out more about that at www.airamericaradio.com.
Oh, I should say something else about that. You know, you're kind of right when you say we're on all the time, because we now, courtesy of Radio Nation, syndicate a one-hour commercial-free version to non-commercial community radio stations all over the country, about 100 of them.
Oh, terrific.
So there's both the live call-in show and this one-hour public radio version, which maybe you'd be interested in.
Very much so. And you also have a website, Laura, lauraflanders.com, and I imagine there's all sorts of goodies there for people if they're interested in following up and stuff. Another big story I'd like to talk about with you, Laura, is Robert F. Kennedy's huge article that came out in Rolling Stone this week, in which he argued quite strongly that the Republicans stole the 2004 presidential election.
Yeah, really powerful piece. We talked about it some last night.
And, you know, it's what's striking is Mark Crispin Miller, Joel Bleifuss, a number of people have written books, and I think fairly highly regarded books, making this case. But it's such a incendiary argument to make that the presidential election was stolen. Everyone knows in 2000 that Gore actually won the election, but they said, okay, that was, you know, you're allowed to get one every century that's blown, or one every 50 years. But the idea that this one was literally stolen, you know, someone that even people who are anti-Bush have been very hesitant to embrace this argument for fear of being accused of being conspiratory wackos. And, you know, some of my best friends and some of the guests on the show have poo-pooed the story almost instantly when anyone would raise it or any caller would raise it. But now along comes Robert F. Kennedy, a fairly highly regarded figure in liberal politics in this country, certainly a respected figure, to make as powerful an argument as I've seen. What's your take on the article, the argument he's making, and the response?
Well, a lot of things in there. As speaking as one of those conspiratorial wackos, I'll tell you, my interest in this story and my belief that something very bad went down began election night when I got the overnight shift at Air America covering the election results and started getting calls. We have a station in Columbus, and we started getting calls at 2 in the morning from people who just then had been able to cast a ballot and who called us that evening and said there was a very serious problem here. We've always had 4 polling machines. We had 2 polling machines. They sent people away. They were challenging voters. So we knew at my program that there was a problem from the beginning, and I have to claim just a teeny bit of credit, not so much for me, but for independent media, if you like, in that we started hearing these stories, and it wasn't the Democrats on the ground who first investigated what had happened. It was independent groups like the League of Independent Voters and FreePress.org. You had Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman bringing together a legal team that my listeners helped to raise money for, that produced a lot of the material that was then included in the Conyers report, all of which is to say, you know, thank heavens to this kind of ecology that we've created of independent media, that some of this data actually exists. And this is a story that has been gathering moss, in a good way, as it rolls. And to now be in Rolling Stone, how appropriate the metaphor, I guess, and to have Robert Kennedy fronting it, I think is very, very powerful and a very interesting, you know, sad. It shouldn't have to be this way, but it's an interesting study on how a story grows legs and grows credibility over a long period of time, and thank heavens for all those who've not given up on it. Kennedy is very strong. He pulls together a lot of information. He says, you know, that this is a story that wasn't in one state alone. It was in several. It's a story that reveals discrepancies that were higher in battleground states, higher where there were Republican governors, higher where there were greater proportions of African Americans, higher where there were the most election day complaints. And if it had been another country, we would have said, no question, there are strong indicators of fraud. One of the biggest indictments in this piece and in the books that he references is the indictment of the media, who on election night, the 6 media organizations that had commissioned exit polling, and they had supposedly overhauled their whole process since 2000, instead of treating the discrepancies between what the exit polls suggested and what the results, the certified results suggested, simply scrapped the exit polls, scrubbed the results from their websites. Again, if it had been another country, we're talking about discrepancies that in some cases came down to, you know, a three chance in a billion that an exit poll could be this far off, and that every discrepancy would favor Bush over Kerry, and that the media, instead of making the question of this discrepancy a story, as they were to do, you know, later in Ukraine, simply dismissed all question about it and didn't investigate almost everyone except for Keith Olbermann, apparently in MSNBC. You know, is a indictment of the media. On the question of the results of Kennedy, I mean, Kennedy's piece, it's not perfect. It doesn't include proposals for what could be done, which I think is unfortunate because there are very clear proposals coming out of the Conyers report, coming out of Bob Fitrakis's work. And that's what we need to get people mobilized around. As long as this is just a kind of backward-looking story, it won't have the momentum that a forward-looking story could have. But you know what? He's not a lawyer. He doesn't have subpoena power. And the criticism that I've heard already all has to do with minute detail, that maybe this number is a little off or that number is a little off. People are coming down with a, you know, truckload of bricks on his reporting. And again, he's a journalist. He's done his best, but this is not a legal document. And I think the alacrity with which some have already jumped on his piece that first appeared last Thursday shows the deep desire that exists out there to brush this under the carpet.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Laura Flanders. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the host of Radio Nation with Laura Flanders, which can be heard on Air America Radio and also is on roughly 100 public and community stations around the country in the non-commercial version, an hour every week. Go to lauraflanders.com to learn more about Laura and her work. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Laura Flanders, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And before we go to the phone lines, just to follow up on this, you know, you were talking about the exit polls, and I recall in 2000 that, of course, it showed that Al Gore won Florida by the exit polls, and everyone announced he was the winner. And then, of course, we had the enormous controversy, and eventually Bush was made president. But now it looks like those exit polls in Florida were absolutely correct. I mean, had the votes been counted, the people coming out of the polls thought they'd elected Gore, basically.
Right.
And I agree, the exit polls are used as the gold standard to measure whether ballot counts are accurate everywhere else. I mean, that's considered more reliable, as reliable as you could possibly get. Yet here, they were just dismissed categorically across the board.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. The exit polls were what saved us in 2000, or maybe didn't save us, but alerted us to our fate, at least alerted us that something was up. In this case, the exit polls did exactly the same thing. You know, Robert Kennedy even quotes Dick Morris, who's worked for both parties, saying exit polls are almost never wrong. And yet they were completely dismissed out of hand. And anybody that said, excuse me, how come Kerry was said to be winning with an insurmountable lead at 8 o'clock at night? And as Kennedy reports, you know, Tony Blair went to bed in Britain assuming that he was going to be having a relationship with President-elect Kerry. And in the next couple of hours, you saw flips, not by a little amount in some of these circumstances, but, you know, by huge differences in every case favoring George W. Bush. And very interestingly, one of the points that's made in this article, and I can't find it. Oh, yeah, here it is. He says, you know, in precincts where Bush received at least 80% of the vote, the exit polls were off by an average of 10%. That is a big difference. In precincts where Kerry dominated by 80%, in which case, you know, districts which are hard, fast blue, you weren't going to flip them, the exit polls were accurate to within 0.3%.
Hmm.
Which, again, if this was another country, we would have said there was, you know, ballot stuffing in Bush country, and definitely have had an investigation. Now, you know, the sad thing here is we kind of did have an investigation. I mean, Congress did investigate. John Conyers' office investigated. They came out with a damning report, which has more than appears in this Rolling Stone article. You had members of Congress in 2005, as they hadn't in 2001, officially contesting the results on the floor of the Senate, which did not happen 4 years earlier. And still, this story was poo-pooed, and they're absolutely right. Cast as the sole, you know, property of loonies.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Laura Flanders, the host of Radio Nation with Laura Flanders, heard every Friday, Saturday and Sunday on the Air America Radio Network. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Salina, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi. Oh, it's great to get to talk to you. It's a great opportunity. Thank you. I wanted to ask about a couple of things. First of all, the Carter Group and their monitoring of our election. And then right before the election, some UN, I think it was, international election monitors came into the country and whatever happened to them. And then as far as Kerry's concession, his public early concession, he conceded before, even by their numbers, he had actually won. And then what's happening with the impeachment proceedings with Conyers and all that?
Well, on the impeachment proposal, I think there are now close to 100 signatories, it may even be more, people calling for a debate.
In Congress?
In Congress. On the question of the UN observers, I'm curious, too. They weren't in Ohio. They were in Florida. I don't know where else they were, and I haven't heard the report. And as far as Jimmy Carter's investigation, I have not seen that report, but I understand that it, too, raised red flags and said there was a problem here. I don't know why more hasn't been made of that either. Again, you have, in this case, a former president speaking out, not in as strong terms as you have here. And on Kerry's concession, not only did John Kerry concede before the final results were in, he conceded while there was actually a recount in the works, and he conceded before John Edwards was willing to concede. And Edwards, who in the late hours of election night said, pledged to his supporters, to Democratic voters, that every vote would be counted in Ohio, is said by reporters to have been utterly infuriated, exasperated, and made desperate by Kerry's feeble response to this story. You know, I hope that, I mean, I don't have the answers, but we need to talk about solutions to some of this stuff. And one of them is a federal election law that Jesse Jackson Jr. has been proposing that would establish a single standard system of elections in this country, so you'd have one rule book to go by, not 113,000, that would establish non-partisan board of elections and election supervisors and monitors, so that you wouldn't have an elected Secretary of State who, like Blackwell, like Catherine Harris, was also co-chair of the Republican presidential campaign in that state. He has several other suggestions, which I think it's important for people to get around and get behind, because the Congress has been very nervous to support another change to the voting system for fear that we would get something worse than the Help America Vote Act, which was largely used to try to put up more obstacles to voters and to advance the profits of these private vote counting machines and to privatize our voting system. But a lot of people have got it now that this is, you know, we worry about our constitutional rights. Well, we don't have any if our elections aren't legal, if our elections aren't an accurate reflection of, U.S. opinion. And you can say they never have been, but all the more reason why we should work vigorously for change, particularly as we see ever more devious means and some of the old means coming into play every 4 years.
Laura Flanders, you recall certainly, and I remember you covered this on Congressman, and Fair covered this a great deal back in 1998 when it came out that President Clinton might not have told the truth about having oral sex with Monica Lewinsky.
I remember something about that.
Yeah, you remember that. It was the dominant news story in the United States for a good year, completely dominating our attention as Clinton was impeached and his impeachment went before the U.S. Senate. George W. Bush has had a fairly interesting record with regard to the Constitution. Many have called for his impeachment, yet it has received far less attention in the news media and far less discussion in the general political culture. What's the story there? What's your take on this?
Well, very interestingly, I think, we had on our program this yesterday Bruce Fein, whose name you may remember from the Clinton impeachment story, in that he was one of the conservative lawyers, he'd been a deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration, who prepared a memo that apparently informed the Ken Starr crew and, you know, encouraged the route of impeachment for Bill Clinton. Now, you know, he'll explain why he did it in that case, and he felt that, and he said on the program, it was because a president should be held to account for not dissembling to the Congress, not once, not twice. He is not yet at the point of supporting impeachment of George W. I don't know why, but he is for Russ Feingold's censure resolution, and he testified in favor of it in Congress. And he also appeared in the House on Monday or Tuesday of last week, roundly condemning this White House and the executive under George W., whom he says is basically reduced Congress to a bit player in a Cecil B. DeMille movie, and he roundly denounced Congress, too, for putting up with it. So here you have a conservative player in U.S. politics for 35 years with whom you could have a very interesting conversation about impeachment, who is utterly in favor of a censure resolution, which I think is, you know, should be very simple proposition, and yet still only got two members of the Democratic Party supporting it when Feingold tried to propose it last month. And still, you know, and appearing live in Congress, and still no coverage. So maybe it's in the category of our elections have been stolen, the too hot to handle category for the media. But I wonder how long it'll last.
Laura Flanders, our guest. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, on a cell phone traveling from Chicago to Champaign. You're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Yes, I'd like to know what both of you think about the Nancy Pelosi statement that if the Democrats retake the House, that impeachment will be off the table. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. So Nancy Pelosi, head of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, said that even if they retake the House next year, impeachment's not something that she will want to pursue.
Well, sometimes I wonder if these Democrats actually want to get elected. You know, and the other thing she said was going to be the priority for the new democratically controlled House was going to be competency and oversight. You know, well, I don't want war on terror more competent. I don't want war on Iraq more competent. I don't want more oversight of spying on Americans. We need a real change in direction. And frankly, her statement around impeachment falls into the category of, you know, loser Democrats. And when are we going to see a shift?
You know, the Democrats, everyone's been talking about how 2006 off-year election is going to be their big breakthrough, return to power that they haven't had since 1994, that the Bush administration now, I think its ratings, depending on which poll you look at, the personal approval ratings of President Bush are in the high 20s or low 30s. What's your take? Do you think the Democrats—
I'm not sure there is anything as such as high 20s. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. They're in the 20s, upper 20s, 25 to 29%. What's your take? Do you think the Democrats are poised to return to power in Congress and then eventually complete the trifecta with the presidential victory in 2008?
Well, this whole return to power concept is confusing in that they could return to a majority, whether they would actually use deploy and grasp any power. I don't know. I think we could see enough gains in seats around the country to produce a Democratic majority in the House. But from the work that I've been doing on this book, that will not be because people are, you know, wooed to Nancy Pelosi. That would be because grassroots folks and progressives who've never been involved in electoral politics as they are today are holding their noses and getting involved and giving it a try to transform this Democratic Party. I've found it in Montana, I've found it in Nevada, I've found it in California, Florida, Wisconsin, Minnesota, you name it. You find people who 10 years ago would never have gone near an election as an activist, who absolutely sort of eschewed political party politics, saying, okay, I'll do it. You know, I'll get involved. I'll organize primaries. I'll help recruit candidates because we need a turnaround. And I think that we might see that in this coming Tuesday, where we're seeing primary races in a lot of interesting places around the country. And I've been following not only the California races and some of the others, but also South Dakota, where you have a lot of progressive, pro-choice Democratic women running in Democratic primaries against pathetic, loser, backward-looking Democrats who voted for this abortion ban. The Democratic Party would have you believe it was only extreme Republicans who voted for this thing, the one that has no exception for rape, incest, or a woman's health. But it's not true. You had 4 out of 10 Democrats in the Senate voting for it. And you've now got these progressive women, many of them Native Americans, running in primaries, giving them a real run for their money with national and as well as local support. We're seeing some interesting stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the route tracked by Pelosi is what's responsible. And that's what's going to be difficult to take apart. If they emerge, quote-unquote, victorious in November of this year, the conclusions they draw from that may not be the right ones.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Laura Flanders, host of Radio Nations with Laura Flanders, heard every Saturday and Sunday night on the Air America Radio Network, which you can learn about at airamericaradio.com. You can also go to lauraflanders.com to learn more about what Laura Flanders is up to. She's working on a new book on progressive politics, the state of progressive politics in the USA, and she's written several books in her career that we've had to talk about, including Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. Our phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines where we've had some very patient people. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi. I wanted to ask about Condi. I know you wrote Bushwoman. I only read some sections of it, but I watched Fox News this morning and saw Britt Hume congratulate her for, you know, a masterful stroke, sort of a pre-checkmate move, you know, to get the Russians and the Chinese on board. And then Juan Williams, who took this offer seriously, apparently thought, well, you know, now she's won over Rumsfeld and we're going to negotiate. And I just think it's such a crock. I mean, frankly, what can I say? I'm getting apoplectic here again. So I wanted you to comment on that. And it's way away from electoral politics, except the fact that you managed in all the Democratic women running, but there's, I think the disaffection, the gender gap is something that you might want to comment on too, because I think there are a lot of Republican women falling away as well, just generally, and independent women are. I think the statistics, one of the polls I heard about was that I think there's like a 10 or 12, 15% falling away more for the fairer. The wiser sex, actually. I'll listen on the air. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Gina. Interesting. Well, those gender numbers, it's pretty much true. It has been true for the last few elections that, you know, at this time of the year, you've got a big gender gap favoring the Democrats, and by the time it comes to election season, they manage to have destroyed it, usually by so backing away from anything that might be seen as a feminist position on anything that they just cut off their nose despite their face. But, on the Condi thing, I'm afraid to confirm your listeners' view, this is a crock. And the particularly shameful thing of the reporting this week, I have to give credit to Tim Russert for having not Condoleezza Rice, but Hans Blix on the program. You know, this whole statement from Condoleezza that they would, after all, agree to join the table of talks with the Europeans and Iran, it came, you know, the day before Hans Blix of the Atomic Energy Agency, the people that surveil the state of nuclear proliferation. The day before, Blix came out with a new report saying, you know, the United States was the number one worst offender when it came to nuclear proliferation. And the problem, you know, refusing to sign the non-proliferation treaty, backing away from the test ban treaty, you know, generally adopting a military response to any supposed nuclear threats, namely Iraq, and sending the message to the world that the whole non-proliferation international treaty structure wasn't worth the paper it was written on. So you have Blix at this one time saying, you know, the U.S. is the scofflaw and it's leading the world down a dangerous path. Then you have Condi getting all the coverage when she says, we're willing to meet because we care so much about nuclear proliferation in Iran. The trouble with the Iranian coverage, I mean, the coverage of Iran and the debate with the United States, is it hasn't put the tension between the two countries into the context of the nuclear arms race and the history of U.S. violations of nuclear treaties. We seem in the U.S. And it's very different if you look at coverage in other countries, in India, in Britain, in most of the Middle East. The reporting is much more about the Iraqi power development program and possible weapons program as a violation, not of kind of U.S. ego or its friends, you know, in the region, namely Israel, but rather as it relates to international anti-proliferation treaties. And to that end, people have been proposing, well, let's give them a light water reactor instead if they want nuclear power, but we don't want them to have nuclear weapons. But it's very hard to get people, anyone, to come to the table to talk about signing up to a nuclear non-proliferation treaty when the biggest nuclear proliferator out there is thumbing its nose at the whole idea of a treaty structure that might work. So that's not about Condi so much as how her, you know, statements, her proclamations this week were covered. But I think it gets to the heart of it. We need to be talking about nuclear proliferation and Iran and United States as threats to non-proliferation.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Salina, Illinois. This is a hotbed of Media Matters listeners, apparently. Welcome to the air.
Hi from the hotbed. You just said it. Bush had a chance to talk about non-proliferation. Well, not that he would, but...
He's against it.
Yeah, and the dangers of nuclear power itself, it's and the media just lets it go. I wanted to make a kind of a humorous comment. They treat the stealing of elections and the impeachment issue like it's a paranormal topic, like it should be relegated to UFO reports and whatever. And one other thing is is there any chance of any big war anti-war demonstrations or impeachment demonstrations? This seems like it did get some footing in the anti-war demonstration before the invasion. Any comments? Oh, and I've listened to your reporting on Counterspin on KPFA in Berkeley since the 90s. So thank you, Laura Flanders.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, Laura?
Well, one of the most interesting stories I saw this week was the story coming from Olympia and Seattle, Washington, where you had activists doing their best and doing not a bad job of trying to shut down a port that was going to be releasing a boat with supplies for Iraq, a naval shipment for Iraq. And you had local activists setting up camp there in Olympia, Washington, for I think a whole week and escalating their protests. They didn't stop the shipment, but they sure gave those who were trying to ship those supplies, and we don't know exactly what they were, a hard time. And yeah, I'd like to see the big demonstrations, but I'd like to see more of that kind of action, too. And I think that's what's ultimately going to make this war impossible to continue. The small scale, people throwing their bodies on the cogs in the machine, that's what is going to make the difference, I think, because we've become, I'm afraid, rather used to enormous million-strong demonstrations being covered as barely hundreds in the media, and not getting much of a response from Washington anyway. Clearly, we have to do both, but I think the taking on your local military supplier is a great way to go.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today you've been listening to is Laura Flanders, host of Radio Nation with Laura Flanders, which can be heard on the Air America Radio Network. Go to airamericaradio.com to learn about it, or go to lauraflanders.com. It's a pleasure having you today, Laura. We've got a few more minutes left, and we've got some people patiently waiting to speak with you, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, historic Urbana, Illinois. You're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Yeah, going back to the thing about Pelosi's statement, I guess I'm looking for someone to disagree with me, either of you, that it sounds like a Democratic victory would this coming season would really be a blow to progressive politics because we would just throw accountability out the window. Is that where you're coming from? That's kind of my position. And also, what alternatives do you see?
What do you mean by blow accountability out the window?
I apologize. We lost the call in the meantime.
I don't think I quite know what he meant.
Maybe that.
What you mean, the refusal to impeach means we're just going to let them get away with it?
Yeah, if I can put words into the caller's mouth, I mean, this is a question I've gotten quite a bit. People say, well, if what President Bush has done in Iraq and in a number of other areas isn't impeachable, why don't we just take impeachment out of the Constitution? Because it basically does, it means it's never going to be enforced.
Well, I think it's still, I mean, we're way down the road here. We haven't got a Democratic majority in Congress. We don't have Democrats in control of either House of Congress. If you did have a majority Democratic Congress, you'd have John Conyers at the head of the Judiciary Committee. I can't imagine he would do what Pelosi tells him on this impeachment story. And I think that there are many months between now and then to try to influence our elected officials. I say all this not because I think the Democrats will save us, but because I really do not see an alternative at this point. And I do see enough roiling inside the Democratic Party at the bottom level that I'm in favor of fueling that right now rather than prematurely, or maybe it's not premature, but rather than our options at this point, which seem to be sitting the election out or voting for third-party candidates that don't stand a chance at the national level, at the local level for sure, but until we change our election system, they don't stand a chance. Now, am I in favor of powerful primary races like, Marcy Winograd's this week in California against Jane Harman, or Ned Lamont's in Connecticut against Joe Lieben, which he might win? Absolutely, because it's a chance to use the campaign as an opportunity for a very powerful discussion that we need to have. But I don't know, Pelosi has moved at least a little on the war over the last few months and years. Maybe we can move her on impeachment, or maybe I'm just ridiculously idealistic.
We'll find out soon enough. I don't know if you're ridiculously idealistic. I think you're idealistic.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, like, I'm not really sure. I agree. It remains.
Don't vote Democrat because it encourages them.
No, I'm not in that school of thought. I've never been. But you know, I think that your answer, I think, was the right one.
Okay, good.
Let's go. Yeah, you get an A on that one. And I'm not even using my curve. Let's go back to the phone lines here. Royal Illinois, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi, Ms. Sanders. I'm glad we're all talking about the Democrats, and, you know, I think their projected victory is somewhat premature, you know. But I want to get back to the whole Iranian issue. It's really funny for me. I was just wanting to get your comment on this. It's really funny for me that but France, Britain, and the U.S., and maybe throw China in there maybe once in a while, and Russia, call themselves like they're the international community, you know, whenever they're discussing this issue. You know, as the international community, you know, the Condi Rice, she was on Fox News and, you know, once again reiterating these five or six people saying the will of the international community. I think it's just comical, you know.
Right.
It's downright pathetic, you know. So I'll hang up and listen to you.
Oh, well, ditto. I mean, I agree. I don't know what else to add to that. It's insane. And there have been people working for, you know, one of the interesting things that was said today by Joe Biden, I know you wouldn't think that sentence would come out of my mouth.
Yeah, that's a shocker right there.
But he said, I think it was him this morning on Meet the Press, he said, you know, the reason that the Congress gave, I mean, it's a crap reason, but the reason that the Congress gave war powers to, you know, power to the president after 9/11 was because, he didn't say anything about 9/11. He said it was because, I don't mean after 9/11. I mean, what was he talking about? Anyway, he said the whole world wanted to remove sanctions from Iraq. And we, meaning the United States, as he perceives it, had to, you know, try to pull them back from that. And there you had the whole world referring to what was, in fact, the whole world. I mean, you had, you know, an international initiative that at one point Dick Cheney had actually supported to reduce sanctions on Iraq. And it was interesting to hear Biden actually say that aggression on Iraq was not so much about Iraq, but about the whole world and the U.S. standing up to the quote-unquote whole world. Today, it seems like we've managed to shrink the whole world back to where we like it, which is us and just a few other rich industrialized nations. But there has been a movement by that same group of whole world that wanted to reduce sanctions on Iraq. to change the structure of the United Nations and the Security Council to more accurately reflect the actual world. And I'm hoping we can get back to those discussions one of these days.
Laura Flanders, you've written and spoken a lot about women in politics. You wrote the book Bush Women, but you've also talked about women in the Democratic Party and progressive politics. If one watches Fox News or much of our mainstream news media, the impression they would get of Hillary Clinton was of a rabid feminist, environmentalist, left-leaning politician. So then for people who share those political views, her projected nomination as the candidate for president of the Democratic Party in 2008 probably welcome news. Is that an accurate picture of Hillary Clinton?
No, it's an utterly inaccurate picture of Hillary Clinton. She was never really any of those things. And you're right, she has been created as a kind of straw woman, as the radical feminist. I think the only radical thing she ever did was try to keep her so-called maiden name when she married Bill Clinton. She's four children. If that makes you a feminist, then great. But she's never made a tremendous mark supporting a woman's right to choose or, strengthening the position of the Democratic Party on violence against women or equal pay or any of the things that people who vote primarily on women's issues want to see leadership on today. So you're right, they create this person who they cast as a radical feminist, and then she's either A, not radical enough, or B, too radical, and the reality of what she actually stands for gets lost. What I'm most concerned about now in the coverage of Hillary Clinton is this assumption that she's the presumptive candidate, because I've spoken to an awful lot of people, even big funders of the Democratic Party, who say there are a lot of doubts inside the party. It's far less firm and decided than you would think. I think we need to keep this discussion, A, for another day, because we're nowhere near the presidential race, and B, way more open than it is at this moment, because the Clintons are benefiting from people thinking there should be no debate, or there's no point in a debate. There's every kind of point. And her positions on the war, on women's rights, frankly, where the best she can say is there shouldn't be abortions, and she's willing to meet with the right and the religious right on it, where she hasn't taken a strong position on even the minimum wage or refinancing and re-inscribing the Violence Against Women Act, all things that you'd think would be an easy target for her. All of that is leaving a lot of questions on a lot of people's minds, not to mention this overused word of viability. Is she viable in other, non-coastal states? So, I mean, I think we should say there is no presumption here at all.
Well, let's go. We have one caller who's been very patient. One for Chicago. We've only got a few seconds left. Do you have a condensed question for Laura Flanders?
Well, I want to comment on this whole drive for the impeachment of Bush. I think it's nonsense. If you want to get rid of Bush, you have to first get rid of Cheney one way or another, have him replaced by a Democrat, a liberal Democrat, and then go after Bush. And this will take all of your time, much more than 2 years.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. What's your take on that, Laura?
Well, I don't think that you need to say, we're going to dedicate all our resources to impeachment, but can we have impeachment proceedings that would enable us, speaking as Democrats, to acquire information, to subpoena documents? I don't think that would be a waste of time at all. But the caller's right that the ultimate end of replacing Bush with Dick Cheney is not the goal. The goal is to unravel and reveal some of what's happened in the last 6 years and to leave a public record that, in the absence of that, I think will disappear.
Laura Flanders, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been terrific for you to take an hour of your time to join us.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank my listeners, Brett Paulson, our technical person in there running the board, John Anderson sitting in today, the Media Matters Minutes guru doing our producing today in replacement of Andrew Boyle. I'm Bob McChesney, and I'll be back in 167 hours. Take care.